Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivana Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivana Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vannachari. Yamuna Tira Vannachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivana Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivana Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vannachari. Yamuna Tira Vannachari.
Hare Krishna. Good morning, everyone. I'd just like to start by reading the translation to the song we just sang. I know for myself it's always helpful to hear the English as well as the Sanskrit. Krishna is the lover of Radha. He displays many amorous pastimes in the groves of Vrindavan. He is the lover of the cowherd maidens of Vraj, the holder of the great hill named Govardhan, the beloved son of Mother Yashoda, and the delighter of the inhabitants of Vraj. He wanders in the forest along the banks of the river Yamuna. So I'd like to thank everybody for being here this morning, especially after sounds like quite an adventure yesterday. I hope everyone had a good time. Some of you are looking better than others, but I also just wanted to express my gratitude to all of you for allowing me to be here this week with you all, and for hosting me so nicely. And, of course, Krishna House holds a very dear place in my heart. It's where I kind of came to Krishna consciousness, and I have very fond memories of it, and I'm I'm sure wherever all of you end up going after the summer or after this semester or after this year, your memories at Krishna House are sure to stick with you and keep you inspired in Krishna consciousness. So, thank you all. I beg the blessings of the senior devotees here, Paul Bhasin Prabhu, Gopal Prabhu, Chaitanya Dasi, and Kalakanta Prabhu, for that I may speak something beneficial today. I'm speaking here mostly for my own purification, and I hope, hopefully, at least some of you will get something beneficial from this class. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Please chant with me. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. We can do it together. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Tato jayam udirayet nastaprayishva badreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati tamash loke bhaktir bhavati naishtaki. So today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, second canto, first chapter, text 14 and 15. We will chant the Sanskrit for text 14. Tavapyetari koravya Saptaham jivitavadihi Upakalpayatat sarvam Tavadyat samparayikam Tvapyetari koravya Saptaham jivitavidihi Upakalpaya tatsarvam Tavadyat samparayikam Tvapyetari koravya Saptaham jivitavadihi Upakalpaya tatsarvam Tavadyat samparayikam. Please chant. Saptaham jivitavadihi Tavadyat samparayikam Tavapyetari koravya Saptaham jivitavadihi Upakalpaya tat sarvam. Tvapyetari kauravya Saptaham jivitavadihi
Upakalpaya tatsarvam
Tavadyat samparayikam
Tvapyetari
kauravya Saptaham jivitavidihi Upakalpaya tat sarvam Okay, we'll do the word for word.
Tava
your
api
also
etari
therefore
koravya
O son born in the family of Kuru.
Saptaham,
7 days. Jivita,
duration of life.
Avidihi,
up to the limit of.
Upakalpaya,
get them performed.
Tat,
those.
Sarvam,
all.
Tavat,
so long.
Yet,
which are.
Samparayikam,
rituals for the next life.
Would somebody like to read the translation?
Maharaj Parikshit, now your duration of life is limited to 7 more days. So during this time, you can perform all those rituals which are needed for the best purpose of your next life.
Continue with the purport, please.
Sukadev Goswami, after citing the example of Maharaj Khatwanga, who prepared himself for the next life within a short time, encouraged Maharaj Parikshit by saying that since he still had 7 days at his disposal, he could easily take advantage of the time to prepare himself for the next life. Indirectly, the Goswami told Maharaj Parikshit that he should take shelter of the sound representation of the Lord for the 7 days still remaining in the duration of his life, and thus get himself liberated. In other words, everyone can best prepare himself for the next life simply by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, as it was recited by Sukadev Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit. The rituals are not formal, but there are also some favorable conditions which are required to be carried out as instructed hereafter.
Thank you. So, I guess briefly, I would just like to kind of get the context of what's going on. I know for myself, when I read Bhagavatam, sometimes I get kind of lost in the what's happening at the moment, and I kind of lose sight of the bigger picture. So, can somebody tell me kind of what's happening at this section of the Bhagavatam? Maybe who is speaking? Okay. Shukadev Goswami, can somebody tell me who Maharaj Parikshit is?
He's the king of the world.
Okay. He is. Does anybody know who is his? Are his parents? He is. Yes, he's Arjuna's grandson. I believe he is Abhimanyu's son and also Uttara. Yes. So here Maharaj Parikshit has been cursed to, he has 7 days left to live. Can somebody tell me the story why he was cursed? Wabhasane Prabhu.
He was cursed by an inexperienced Brahmin boy who was the son of a sage who he made it a very, very slight offense to. Hmm. When the son heard about the offense, he immediately cursed Maharaj Parikshit to die within 7 days to be bitten by a snake bird. And so at that time, he gave up all of his responsibilities as emperor of the planet. He gave up his huge treasury and his huge army and his wife and children, and he immediately left. He left the kingdom in the care of his sons. And went to search out the absolute truth, and he went to the bank of the Ganges, and there he met with the sages, and at that time Shukadeva Goswami appeared and spoke to him the Srimad Bhagavatam, and this is the beginning of that.
Yes, thank you. So I just like everybody to take a moment. I know this is kind of a heavy question early in the morning and in general. But here we can see that Maharaj's Parikshit is dealing with this fact that he has 7 days to live. So what if you were told that you only had 3 months to live? That, you know, maybe you were feeling kind of ill one day and you decided it was bad enough to go to the doctor, and he told you that, look, we've checked you out and you have some terminal form of disease, some cancer or something, and you've only had 3 months to live. What would you do with your time, or perhaps how would that change maybe your relationships with people? How would that change your devotional practice? Who would you like to visit? Basically, I was thinking about this question for myself and really trying to put myself in this position. I know it's hard to in kind of like a hypothetical way because we're not really in that position, most of us, at least that I know of. But basically, I came up with three kind of possible outcomes or responses to this situation. Can anybody tell me maybe what are some possible, like how people might react to? I'm sorry? Yes, enjoy to the maximum. Go far, Prabhu.
Well, this is something Mother Lakshmi Moni said because she had a stroke several months ago, and so she felt kind of close. I remember hearing her give a class shortly after that, and it's something I thought was really good that I remembered, and it's two forgets and two remembers. It's forget all the good things you've done for other people, forget all the bad things other people have done to you. Never forget you can die at any moment, and never forget the power of the holy name. So I thought that was really good. Those are the good things to do at the time of death, you know, to forgive it, to think, you know, to treat everybody like this is going to be, you know, your last moment.
Any other thoughts, ideas? Yeah, basically, of course, one option is, some people may become kind of, they may go into denial or kind of become depressed or anxiety ridden, despondent. And I've seen this happen in several cases in my own life of people close to me kind of are faced with this situation and they become bewildered and then they just kind of shut down, you know, emotionally and don't really know how to deal with this situation. Then of course there's what was your name, Prabhu? Yeah. Brajaharidas. Yes, I'm sorry. Brajaharidas was saying another option is just enjoy to the maximum. I'm not sure if anybody has heard of this movie called The Bucket List. It's a movie that came out a few years ago. I was fortunate enough not to see it, but basically it was a story of these two men played by Jack Nicholas and Morgan Freeman. I believe, I only saw the previews for it, but I believe the idea is that there's these two people in a hospital who are diagnosed with lung cancer and given only like a year or 6 months to live. And so one of them, I believe Morgan Freeman, starts creating this list of things that he wants to do before he dies. And Jack Nicholas's character is also happens to be a millionaire, so he encourages him and adds some more things to the list, and then they decide to escape from this cancer ward and try and, you know, check off as many of these things from the list as possible, you know, like skydiving, driving like a Shelby Mustang, you know, so many of like these pinnacles of sense gratification. And I'm not sure exactly how the story turns out. I don't know if it's so important, but also this is kind of a, well, I thought of the example. You all may want to pay attention. This might be the first and last Oprah Winfrey reference that you'll hear in Bhagavatam class. Does everybody know who Oprah Winfrey is? Maybe to our Indian friends? Oprah is she's a prominent African American woman in Western culture. She's kind of like a actor, philanthropist. She has this show called The Oprah Show. Anyways, days that I've been kind of sick or had nothing better to watch on TV before I was a devotee, obviously, I saw the every once in a while they would have like these children with like terminal illnesses come on Oprah or like these other daytime talk shows, and they and the whoever the host was would try and fulfill these children's like all, like greatest desire, you know, like I want to go to Disney World or I want to meet Shaquille O'Neal or Johnny Depp, and Oprah would kind of facilitate these things for these kids, and everybody thought it was nice and like, wow, look at how great Oprah is. And so for us as aspiring spiritualists and devotees, we see that Prabhupada mentions here the proper use of our time, and he says that everyone can best prepare himself for the next life simply by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. So, as devotees, we know that simply by seeing our favorite celebrity or trying to enjoy in some way, that ultimately these things are not going to help us at the time of death. I thought of a few examples. One comes from the Bhagavatam, actually, in the first canto with Dhritarashtra. Everybody remember the story of Dhritarashtra? Okay, well, Dhritarashtra was the father of Duryodhan, and basically at this point the Battle of Kurukshetra has taken place. All of Dhritarashtra's sons, except for I think one, or actually I think all of them were killed. And basically Dhritarashtra is living at the mercy of Yudhishthir, and Yudhishthir is his nephew. So basically one day Vidura, who is Dhritarashtra's brother, comes to Yudhishthir's palace and basically tries to knock some sense into Dhritarashtra and tells him, like, look, your body is falling apart, your teeth are falling out, like, look at how old you're getting, your time is limited left in this body, and you should try to utilize this time for self-realization and to achieve the highest goal. So finally, Dhritarashtra finally kind of gets the point and becomes inspired to go to the Himalayas and practice Ashtanga Yoga. And I think at the end he finally loses his spiritual body and merges kind of into the Brahman effulgence. Also, I was thinking of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. He was diagnosed with, I believe, melanoma cancer, and was given kind of a similar deal, like 6 months to live, or maybe even less. I think he lived much longer than was anticipated, but we can see clearly from his example, he didn't become despondent or kind of morose, but he actually, up until the very end of his life, he was writing his books, the Beggar series, sharing all these wonderful realizations that he was having, connecting with all of his disciples, really just, I think, is an exemplary case of what to do with, you know, when one knows that their time is limited. So, of course, the point I'm trying to get is that any day can be our last, and I know that we hear this a lot, and perhaps we don't like to think about this fact. And the point is not to become morose or distressed about this, but to actually use this fact as an impetus to become more serious and focused in our spiritual life. I think it's actually beneficial and healthy for us to kind of consider this from time to time. Again, Maharaj Yudhishthira, when he, at some point in the Bhagavatam, I think it's the Mahabharata, when he's being questioned by Yamaraj about so many different things, Yamaraj asks Maharaj Yudhishthira, what is the most wonderful thing in this world? And Maharaj Yudhishthira explains that the most wonderful thing is how so many of our grandparents, our parents, brothers, sisters, loved ones are dying around us, and for some reason or other we have this idea that it's not going to happen to us. And I know there's other spiritual traditions that kind of that also meditate on this fact. Like, I don't remember where I read this. I think it was in one of Prabhupada's books. I'm not certain though, so. But I know in the Buddhist tradition that in certain monasteries they actually make some of the furniture out of like human remains, out of like bones and stuff. Just to keep the idea fresh that like this is going to be me in a few years. Like this is what this is where. Yes, Prabhu. Sure. Mm. Sure. Yeah, that was my next example, actually. I watched this documentary on 60 Minutes a few months ago about these monks living on Mount Athos, which is like a, yeah, these Greek Orthodox. Yeah, it was on this show called 60 Minutes, and they do a whole segment on Mount Athos. It's basically this peninsula in Greece where there's 21 monasteries or something like that, and they've been living this basically the same way for over a thousand years, and they're kind of like self-sustaining. A few points that I found interesting were that the monks said their morning program basically is 8 hours a day, and they only get 3 hours of sleep each night. But anyways, the point that I wanted to illustrate was, as Bhakta Clayton was saying, at one point in the documentary, they went to this place on the island, or on the peninsula, where they have these catacombs, this kind of area where they have skulls, the skulls of all the former monks that have lived on the peninsula. And, thousands of skulls, and just again to kind of keep this idea fresh that like, our time is short here and we need to really become serious about this Krishna consciousness. So some of us may think that this is actually a burden to know if we were to know the time of our death, but in some sense it's also a great boon because again we have a chance to really dive deeply into our practice. And as I mentioned, in either case, whether we know or we don't know, simply hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam class or just hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam is the best. The best way to prepare ourselves for death. And then also, Prabhupada, just to kind of elaborate a little more on this purport, at the end he says, the rituals are not formal, but there are also some favorable conditions which are required to be carried out as instructed hereafter. So later we'll see that Prabhupada, well, actually in the Bhagavatam, the verses start talking a little bit about the kind of dhyana yoga a little bit, just some ways that one can actually fix the Supreme Lord in their mind. Okay, so we'll do the text 15 now. I suppose I'll just read the Sanskrit. Antakale tu purusha agate gata sadvashaha chindyada sangas Shastrena Sprihangdehe Nuyechatam. Somebody read the translation, please.
At the last stage of one's life, one should be bold enough not to be afraid of death, but one must cut off all attachment to the body, to the material body and everything pertaining to it and all desires thereof.
Okay, so before we get into the purport, I just wanted to speak a little bit about this verse. So at the last stage of one's life, one should be bold enough not to be afraid of death. To me, this was a very profound statement made by Shukadeva Goswami. Because I think for most of us, at least at this stage, the fear of death is kind of the topmost fear we have, maybe along with public speaking, but so I know this is also kind of maybe a personal or sensitive subject, but has anyone ever had a near-death experience? Or I guess a better question, would anybody like to share about their near-death experience? All the same for both?
First of all, I want to promise everybody this 100% completely true story. I was a relatively new devotee for maybe a couple of months, and I'd been going on Sankirtan every day, distributing Prabhupada's books. And it was a normal night like any other night, and I took rest. And as I was resting, I started to dream. I was asleep. And I jumped. I was climbing up a scaffolding, high, up higher and higher up in the sky. And at first, it was very, very difficult, you know, just to do it. But after a short period of time, I got very good at it. And I was moving through it eventually very quickly, like very fast, expertly up to the top. Finally, I got up to a very high, high point, and there was a beam hanging over the side. I jumped, I got off the scaffolding, straddled the beam, and I looked over. And across from me, there was another scaffolding across the way with another guy, like, sitting on a beam. And we were looking at each other. And I waved to him. And he waved to me, and I started to smile, and he smiled at me, and we started to get into, ha ha, this is so great, we're up here. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the beam dropped. And as the beam dropped, I began to fall through space very, very, very quickly. And as I was falling, this fear that I've never really felt, I remember this very vividly, a fear that I had never felt before in my life came upon me. And my mind started racing like anything, and I started to, every single thing that I had ever pictured within my brain and taken a picture of, I was grasping at it as I was falling. And I was trying to grab hold of something that I had experienced in this life, hoping that it would give me some sort of, you know, shelter, because the inevitable was happening. I was going to die, and I knew it. So I'm falling, and like a spinning reel, like all of these different thoughts were coming very quickly, and I'm madly trying to grab onto them. And then just at the very last second, I see the ground coming up, and everything slows down, like it's total slow motion. And this fear is like completely upon me, and it comes up, and my face hits the bottom. I swear this is true. And Krishna's feet, the deity Gornita's feet, they became boom like the sun. They manifested in my brain.
How do you go?
And they were shining and effulgent, and I sat straight up in bed, and I was completely wide awake. I was sweating, and I got up, took a shower, and started to check my rounds. That's a true story.
Wow.
That was a near-death experience. And then I've heard later on that people would say that when death is upon you, that your life flashes in front of you. And I had no idea what that meant. But after that night, I understood exactly what it meant, that when death is there, when death is very close, and you know it is, you desperately try to avoid that death by trying to take shelter of something within this material world that you've experienced before, hoping that it will save you from death, but it doesn't work.
Thank you. That nicely illustrates what I'm trying to get at. Would anybody else like to share a near-death experience?
Mine is very brief and not nearly as dramatic. I was driving in Pennsylvania, and my car spun out on a snowy road. And I was spinning on the highway right in front of a semi-truck that was just bearing down on me. Actually, just looked through my front windshield, skidding backwards as this truck was just powering straight at me. I had no control of the car. And as a devotee, and I started chanting very sincerely, Krishna, Krishna. And the car just spun off the side of the road, just missed the truck by inches. And I was just trembling like a leaf. But anyway, that was something that made me realize it's good to say the proper thing at those occasions. You know, there's many words you could choose from, like rats or worse. So anyway, that was my experience.
Anyone else?
When I was in India, I was 13 years old, in the Gurukul. Actually, yeah, I had a couple of death experiences, but the one that sticks to in my mind is I almost drowned in the Ganges. And it's very common to the many devotees that go to India for the Mayapur festival. Sometimes they drown. Anyways, we had played soccer for a few hours in the island. And we were coming back, and we had a huge storm. And I decided to be brave and wait until the last minute. And when we were swimming, I kind of got really tired, and I just began swimming, and I got trapped in one of those drill pools, whirlpools, that's what they call. And I began to drink water, and I asked one of my Gurukuli friends to help me out. And he saw that I was going down the water, and I just kept asking for help. At that time, I didn't think of Krishna or anything. I was just drinking water, the Ganges water, and I remember asking, help me. And while I was submerged, the only thing that he saw was my hands. So he grabbed my hand and pulled me out of the water. And that's the only time I remember was just taking this deep breath of air. And then I had two realizations. One was that if I die here, I would have got at least to the heavenly planets, because I'm dying in the Ganges. So sometimes I do blame my friend. Why didn't you let me go? But I don't know. I mean, I didn't think of Krishna. That was my realization, that how come I didn't think of Krishna. I was more concerned of taking that deep breath.
Thank you. Yeah, these are all very kind of intense, nice examples. I had a couple myself, but I don't know if I'll share them. The thing is, I don't think I was actually so close to death, but I was thinking that I was. I'll share one quick one. It was kind of funny that you mentioned this story called Kanta Prabhu, because you probably don't remember this, but actually there was an experience on the way driving from Montana to Idaho that was kind of helped to illustrate what you were speaking about. So this was the first time I had met devotees, and I decided to go with them to Idaho to spend the weekend at the temple. And as you're driving kind of from Montana to Idaho, you're going along a river, and so the road's very windy, and there's kind of a drop-off on one side. And as we were driving, I was sitting in the front seat, and Ananda Seva Prabhu was in the back seat with a couple other devotees. And there was a car, a truck with a trailer coming around the bend in front of us, towards us. And then, clearly it was a no-passing zone, but there was a truck coming around the other side that was trying to pass this trailer, as also, you know, so they were taking up the whole road as we were coming towards them. And this really was a deep impression on me, because I think Ananda Seva and I both yelled out some words that were not so nice. But I remember you specifically yelling out Krishna. And after the whole, like, everything was, you know, the car either sped up and passed just in time, or kind of maybe slowed down and got back in its lane. But either way, this impression was like, wow, this devotee is really Krishna conscious. at least for myself, I have a long way to go before I can claim to be fearless in the face of death. I guess we'll just go ahead and read this purport, just to make sure we get through it before the end of class. We can just take turns reading.
The foolishness of gross materialism is that people think of making a permanent settlement in this world. Although it is a settled fact that one has to give up everything here that has been created by valuable human energy. Great statesmen, scientists, philosophers, etc., who are foolish without any information or spirit soul, think that this life of a few years only is all in all, and that there is nothing more after death. This poor fund of knowledge, even in the so-called learned circles of the world, is killing the vitality of human energy, and the awful result is being keenly felt.
And yet the foolish materialistic men do not care about what is going to happen in the next life. The preliminary instructions in the Bhagavad Gita is that one should know that the identity of the individual living entity is not lost even after the end of this present body, which is nothing but an outward dress only. As one changes an old garment, so the individual's living being also changes his body. And this change of body is called death. Death is therefore a process of changing the body at the end of the duration of the present life.
An intelligent person must be prepared for this and must try to have the best type of body in the next life. The best type of body is the spiritual body, which is obtained by those who go back to the kingdom of Godhead or enter the realm of Brahman. In the second chapter of this canto, this matter will be broadly discussed. But as far as the change of body is concerned, one must prepare now for the next life. Foolish people attach more importance to the present temporary life, and thus the foolish leaders make appeals to the body and the bodily relations. The bodily relations extend not only to this body, but also to the family members, wife, children, society, country, and so many other things which end at the end of life.
After death, one forgets everything about the present bodily relations. We have little experience of this at right when we go to sleep. While sleeping, we forget everything about this body and bodily relations. Although this forgetfulness is temporary situation for only a few hours, death is nothing but sleeping for few months in order to develop other term of bodily engagements which are awarded by law of nature according to our aspiration.
Therefore, one has only to change the aspiration during the course of his present body, and for this there is need of training in current duration of human life. This training can be begun at any stage of life, or even a few seconds before death. But the usual procedure is for one to get the training from very early life, from the stage of Brahmacharya, and gradually process to the Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas orders of life. The institution which gives such training is called Varnashram Dharma, or the system of Sanatana Dharma, the best procedure for making the human life perfect.
One is therefore required to give up the attachment to family or social or political life just at the age of 50 years, if not earlier, and the training in the Vanaprastha and Sannyas ashrams is given for preparation of the next life. Foolish materialists in the garb of leaders of the people in general stick to family affairs without attempting to cut off relations with them, and thus they become victims of nature's law and get gross bodies again according to their work. Such foolish leaders may have some respect from the people at the end of life, but that does not mean that such leaders will be immune to the natural laws under which everyone is tightly bound by the hands and feet.
The best thing, therefore, that everyone voluntarily give up family relations by transferring attachment from family, society, country, and everything thereof to the devotional service of the Lord. It is stated herein that one should give up all desires of family attachment. One must have a chance for better desires. Otherwise, there is no chance of giving up such morbid desires. Desire is the concomitant factor of the living entity. The living entity is eternal, and therefore his desires, which are natural for a living being, are also eternal. One cannot therefore stop desiring, but the subject matter for desires can be changed. So one must develop the desires for returning back home, back to Godhead. And automatically the desires for material gain, material honor, and material popularity will diminish in proportion to the development of devotional service.
A living being is meant for the service. A living being is meant for service activities, and his desires are centered around such a service attitude. Beginning from the top executive head of the state down to the insignificant pauper in the street, all are rendering some sort of service to others. The perfection of such a service attitude is only attained simply by transferring the desire of service from matter to spirit or from Satan to God.
Thank you. So, there's a few points that I wanted to touch on in this purport, but we're kind of running short on time, so... So why do we have this fear of death? So Arjuna Prabhu? We're eternal, we don't want to die. We have attachment to the material body, so kind of Daniel Prabhu?
We want to lord over everything. And so if we want to lord over everything, if we die, we can't do that. And we can't enjoy anymore. So you get really scared that you can't do that.
Sure. I think for myself, the answer that I came up with is this fear of death stems from our lack of faith. Maybe our faith in Krishna, our faith in the process of devotional service, our faith in devotees of Krishna. For if we had full faith in these things, I don't see that any room of fear, really, especially of the fear of death, kind of being able to enter our consciousness. So, does anybody know what this word for firm faith is in Sanskrit? Nishtha, yes. So for those of you that don't know, there's these nine kind of stages of devotional service. And the fifth one of these stages is Nishtha, this firm faith in Krishna. And there's four kind of steps leading up to that, this firm faith. And I wanted to talk just briefly about the preceding step of anartha nivritti. Again, for those of you that don't know, anartha nivritti is this process of kind of cleansing. It's a cleansing of the heart to remove these unwanted desires, these unwanted qualities from our heart. And so in order for us to reach this firm faith, we basically have to become purified to quite a high level. And sometimes we may be a little bit naive and think that somehow or other Krishna is just going to remove these things. Ultimately, Krishna will remove these things from us. But sometimes I think we maybe become a little wishful and think like, okay, I'm not going to have to do anything, and just magically Krishna will take these things away from me without me having to really do anything. Or on the other hand, maybe we become a little hopeless and see how deep-rooted some of these qualities are in us. For myself, I see this selfishness, this jealousy, so many unwanted things. But actually, it is possible in this lifetime to become purified, and we have to keep that as the goal. And I just thought this was relevant because all of us here are living in this community, this ashram, and that's actually the ideal place for this anartha nivritti to take place. Krishna is like the expert surgeon, and he puts certain people and situations in our lives and our surroundings that really can kind of bring these anarthas out in our behavior. And so really, that's kind of the benefit we have, one of the many benefits of living in the ashram, is that we have a chance to work on ourselves and to become introspective, and to, once we live so close with a number of people, we begin to see kind of our true colors, see our faults come out. We see the faults in others, but we have to overlook that. We have to really work on ourselves. So I just encourage everybody to take advantage of this opportunity while however long you're living here at the Krishna house. Maybe some of you haven't really reached this anartha nivritti, but I can assure you that at some point you will. And it may be a very confronting and kind of challenging experience to really see, okay, I'm not such a great person. I thought I was this wonderful person before I was a devotee, but now I'm seeing actually these these nasty things about myself that I didn't know were there, and it's over time more becomes revealed. So please stay strong and really take the advantage of the shelter to really expose yourself and then we can reach this stage of nishta, and in that way we become, as it says in the verse, bold enough not to be afraid of death. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Looks like we have maybe a few minutes for questions, conversation. Shruti Saga Prabhu.
Just came to my mind that you were mentioning how living in the ashram maybe accelerates anatta nivritti. How does it happen? But at one point we leave the ashram, and then like if we don't take sannyas, most probably we'll be into the grihastha ashram. So then I don't know if you can shower some light. How does it happen in that ashram?
Well, clearly I can't really say from first-hand experience, but I can tell you that simply leaving whatever ashram, the brahmachari ashram, brahmacharini ashram, and entering married life, that is certainly another position to accelerate anartha nivritti. I mean, you're living even closer. You're in a closer relationship with somebody, and this one you can't. It's much more difficult to get out of. You kind of have to face these things head on. So even though you're not, in a more of like a communal living, in a sense you still have your partner, and there's certainly going to be, again, Krishna knows how to pair people and to really enable you to overcome some of these things. I'm sure Kalakanta Prabhu has some comments on this.
What becomes a group effort, or what was a group effort, is turned over to a specialist, basically. it's more economic, really. When a person is living in the ashram, you are financially dependent to a certain extent, and becoming economically independent is really the transition in the system from brahmacharya to grihastha. So Prabhupada said that he wanted his devotees to be financially independent and spiritually dependent. So sometimes there is a tendency to want to be grihasthas and live at the expense of the ashram, and in most cases that's not so good. So to answer your question, that's the biggest deal. When you feel like the facilities of the ashram are no longer adequate or not suitable, and you need something more, that's a sign that you're ready to make that transition. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's a very natural growth. The brahmachari ashram, brahmacharini ashrams are not sustainable for life for most people. And it's really the one that you want to get out of, or you will get out of. One devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, is it a fall down if a brahmachari gets married? Prabhupada said, what is the question of fall down? It is already the lowest position.
Yeah, brahmachari. It's the beginning.
You mentioned, when your bad qualities start surfacing and you notice how deeply rooted they are. Sometimes I find this very discouraging. So, what do you do?
Well,
chant, but what if sure, you find yourself chanting offensively, every day? I mean,
I'm reminded of these Bugs Bunny cartoons of, I remember seeing these as a child when, Elmer Fudd would go to pull out these carrots or these vegetables from his garden, and Bugs Bunny would be down holding on to it, and he would be pulling so hard to get this thing out. And for me, that's sometimes what I feel like with my anarthas. Yeah, part of it is just realizing that, as apparently Brahmatirtha Prabhu was emphasizing in his class, that Krishna consciousness is a gradual process, and that this is actually kind of, we should have this as a lifetime aspiration, that it's going to take some time certainly to overcome these anarthas. As for more practical application, I personally just try to take shelter of devotees and reveal my mind to them and tell them my struggles, and hopefully they'll share their struggles with me. So once we realize that we're not alone in this struggle, we can kind of group together and hopefully overcome this as a group. So I think mainly just taking shelter of our devotees, of our friends, of our seniors.